Song after the lesson will be number 408. 408.
Good morning. I invite you to open your Bibles this morning. And I think that one is last week's, yeah. Which maybe we do need to do again. I don't know. That's a Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10 is where we will be this morning. Hebrews chapter 10. Good to see you this morning. Glad that you are here. Hope that y'all are doing okay. Good to see visitors among us this morning. We appreciate so very much the encouragement of our visitors and our guests, and the fact that we see that there are other people looking for God out there. And we're glad that you are here this morning. If you've never been here before and you'd like us to know more about you, reach out to you, study with you. We'd be happy to hear from you. Visitor's card, if you want to leave that behind and leave that with somebody, we'll be happy to follow up with you, talk with you more about God and about knowing Him better. When we sense difficulty or danger, our sense is to panic. Our natural reaction when we see that we are feel that we are in danger is to seek safety, to go somewhere where we think we are secure. And so kids get under their covers or run to mom and dad's room. Sometimes what we do when we get scared and when we almost reflexively seek security and safety, though, can actually be the most dangerous kind of thing at all. Just ask that squirrel who runs out in the street and sees you coming, and rather than finishing it, he would have made it if he kept going, sees you and stops. You ever made that swerve? And then your kids ask, what was that bump? And you say, don't look back. The deer in the night who jumps across the street, sees the headlights and freezes. And now you're calling your insurance company. Somebody who runs right back into danger when they think they're escaping it. That's the irony of that panic reflex sometimes, is that we try to save ourselves and what we wind up doing is the worst thing possible. The book of Hebrews as a whole is a powerful statement about the need for Christians to stay faithful to God despite the difficulties in life that come from being a Christian. The book is loaded with imagery and quotation from the Old Testament. It works to show how Christ is better than Moses, to be sure, about how his sacrificial death is better than the blood of bulls and goats, about how the new covenant he brought is better than the old covenant he ended. The book may well have in many ways been originally intended for Jewish Christians, Christians who through persecution and threat in their own time and place were at risk of abandoning the gospel of Christ for the safe religion of, seemingly safe religion of Judaism. Because for a Jewish person, to be a Christian left you a person without a country. Your own fellow Jews wouldn't accept you in the synagogue anymore. You'd be thrown out of the community of the Jews. And the Romans didn't accept Christians either. And so to go back to a religion where the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was still recognized and worshiped, it may have seemed like a safe and reasonable thing to do. But it wasn't. That standing for Christ could be problematic in the ancient world was certainly well illustrated by the life of Paul, if nobody else. Paul was one of those Jewish Christians who became a man without a country, persecuted in the synagogues among his countrymen, persecuted by the civil authorities in many places as well. And so when the pressure began to build on some early Christians, especially Jewish Christians, when they were pressured and pressed because they confessed that Jesus really was the Messiah, the Son of the living God, the temptation when persecution came to go back to the safety of Judaism became all the stronger. The book itself, the book of Hebrews itself in chapter 10, mentions some of the difficulties that these Christians have already faced in the past in their holding fast. In Hebrews 10, beginning in verse 32, but remember the former days when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through the reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners, and you accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Hebrews reminds the people who got this book originally that they had suffered before. They had even lost property before. Being a Christian had cost them real money. They'd stayed faithful before. They'd endured before. They had made it through storms and trials before. And despite the previous persecutions, you know what? They had survived. They had made it. Maybe a little bit poorer, maybe a little more hassled, but they had endured and they had survived. As chapter 12, verses 1 through 4 points out, and builds on the fact that there is a great cloud of witnesses, the folks who are described in chapter 11, the chapter that we're probably most familiar with in this book, all those folks, Abraham, Noah, the judges, and others, the Hebrew writer says, I don't have time to talk to you about. All these great men and women of faith of days gone by, they constitute a cloud of witnesses, the Hebrew writer says, that surround us. And having them around us, let's lay aside every encumbrance, the sin that so easily ensnares and entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. Second time he uses that word, endure. We endure because they endured, because Jesus endured, despising the shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself. Remember how Jesus put up with the world's antagonism, suffered greatly even unto death. And when you remember that, and when you remember them, you won't grow weary and you won't lose heart. Because after all, you, the Hebrew writer reminds them, and us, I might add, you have not yet resisted the world to the point of shedding blood, and you're striving against sin. It's not gotten that bad for you yet, even though others before you have, and yet they endured. And so that's the call and that's the challenge. You haven't yet reached the point that Jesus did, that others did, those who were torn into pieces and sawn asunder in chapter 11. You haven't reached that point yet. You haven't been to the cross yet, the Hebrew writer says. And yet if they could endure, how much more then should we endure the challenges in life of being a Christian? To be faithful to God, Jesus died at the hands of sinners, persecuted for the message he brought. You haven't been there yet, says the Hebrew writer. And then there's the admonition that he goes on to add later on in chapter 13, in verse 3. The Christians who are tempted to give up or to fall away because it's hard to be a Christian out there sometimes. He better reminds those who aren't in prison. You remember those who are. Remember the prisoners as though you're in prison with them, those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are also in the body. They've suffered before, to be sure. They're going to suffer again, to be clear. And the temptation, and let's be honest, we've all been there, haven't we? We've all felt this temptation, this idea that you just can't take it anymore in life and the problems of life. You've had it, you're through, you think. Especially because you've done enough, you've tried, you've put forth your best effort. And yet life is still hard. And maybe it's just because time and chance happen to anybody. Maybe it's specifically because you're a Christian. Maybe it's because of a dynamic at work or in your family or in your social group. Or especially because you're a Christian, it's hard. You've held on long enough, but now these early Christians are told they're going to have to suffer more, so they need to be prepared for it. And we need to be reminded that the temptation to give in when it's hard to be a Christian, when it's hard to stay faithful, it can be overwhelming. When you're tired, when you're discouraged, sometimes it can seem as though you just don't have any strength left. So especially back in these days, for these Jewish Christians, the easy solution was to go back to a safe and legal religion. My Jewish brethren will accept me and the Romans will leave me alone. And so you find passages like this in Hebrews chapter 10 where they're reminded not to give in to that temptation. Therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let's not fall away. When you realize what you've got in God through Jesus, let's draw near. When time gets harder, you don't fall away, you don't become discouraged, you don't become distracted. You fight your way all the more closer. You hold on all the more dearly. Draw near with a sincere heart and full assurance, confidence in your faith. You know who you believed in. You know what he's done in the past. You know what he's promised in the future. You're fully confident. You remind yourself that God is faithful to his promises. Having hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water, let us hold fast the confession of our hope, he says. Remember when you became a Christian. Why did you become a Christian? You had the hope of eternal life. You remember that, the Hebrew writer says. Confident assurance, confident hope. For he who promised is faithful. He's trustworthy. It's hard today, but today doesn't last forever. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, because part of the answer is to hold on to God intentionally. But also part of the answer is to stay together communally. That's part of the goal. That's part of the point. To stimulate one another to love and to good deeds. To stay together, to worship together, to hold on together. Not forsaking our assembling together, as has become the habit, the custom of some. But all the more encouraging one another as you see the day. What day? The last day. Whether it's your last day or the world's last day. But the end is coming. And when you remember that, the hope that you've confessed, the confident assurance of faith that you've had, you draw near and you keep assembling and you hold on. Elsewhere you find this language in Hebrews, you find this language about holding on to the confession. It's actually a very important idea. Holding on to what you said you believe is true. When you became a Christian, you said you believe Jesus is the Son of God. You said you believe He is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to God except through Him. You've confessed that once upon a time. You hold on to that. Hebrews 3, verses 5 and 6. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and our confession and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Or a little bit later in that same chapter, verses 12 and following, where the Hebrew writer says, "Take care, brethren, lest there be in you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers, sharers of Christ, not just of his death and suffering, but of his life, if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end." And we should take notice that the full context of that often quoted verse about not forsaking the assembly, well, the temptation it would be to avoid the assembly of the saints if it could get you persecuted or worse. But know the Hebrew says, you hold on to what you know is true, what you've said is true, what deep down you know is right, the hope that you've had, you hold on to that firm until the end. And so the writer of the Hebrews wants to show how the first recipients, they're better off with Christ than with Moses, with Jesus' blood and the blood of bulls and goats, with a new covenant that can give life from a transformed heart, rather than an old covenant that just sprinkles water on the body. He wants them to understand what they're really giving up if they leave Christianity for a different way, if they give up on God because life is hard, and sometimes life becomes harder when you're a Christian, ironically. When you come to the far end of the book, on the back side of the book, the Hebrew writer, as he's bringing his sermon, his lesson to a close, leaves, among other things, his hearers with these words. "For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you." If you're confident in the promises of God, you need to remember what those promises are. One of those promises of God, the Hebrew writer reminds us, is that he will never desert us. He will never forsake us. Those words of comfort that were offered at the end of the sermon of people who were hurting because they were trying to do what's right in a fallen world. Well, obviously, if these are Christians, what could be more reassuring in difficult times than the assurance of God's own presence? And obviously, that is one way those words would function within the larger context of the book of Hebrews, to remind them that God is with them even in the hard times. So I want to suggest to you this morning, there's even more going on with these words than just kind of a basic surface-level understanding that what God is offering us is His presence as such, His presence in hard times. That's certainly true, and that's a promise, but there's more going on here than that, and I want to show you how. When you go back early in the book, the Hebrew writer basically lays the foundation of this conclusion back at the beginning of the book in chapter 3. When you go back to the beginning of the book in chapter 3, starting about verse 12, where we were just a moment ago, where he warns them to be careful that there is not an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. When he warns them of that, when you go back and you remember what the Hebrew writer is doing there, we begin to understand how he concludes his letter. And we better understand what it means that God will never leave us or forsake us. Back at the beginning of the book, back in chapter 3 and into chapter 4, the Hebrew writer is asking his troubled and suffering friends to remember the example of Israel under Moses, a generation under Moses that died in the wilderness because of their unbelief. They died in the wilderness because of their unbelief. the implication for those first century Christians and for 21st century Christians is this, and it's pretty simple. Don't repeat the mistake of the Exodus generation who left the Egypt of sin and slavery only to die before they got to the promised land because they didn't hold fast their confession, their assurance, and their hope. They didn't have enough faith to go into the land with God's help. Back in the Hebrews chapter 3, if you begin reading verse 12 and we just read for a little bit, look at what the Hebrew writer does with an old and familiar story. Take care, brethren, that there be not in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ, if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While this said, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts, as when they, Israel, ancient Israel, provoked me. For who provoked them when they had heard? When they knew the truth, they believed the truth. That's why they followed Moses out of Egypt. Indeed, was it not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? They believed, they followed Moses, they followed God, they saw the parting of the sea, they saw the pillar of fire by night, they saw the cloud, they saw Sinai, they saw it all. And they believed. But with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned and whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And what's important in the story is this, when he talks about that they sinned and their bodies fell in the wilderness, he's not talking about some of those other stories that we often think about, you know, where Korah, Dathan, and Abiram do what they do and the earth swallows them up, or the golden calf incident. That's not what he's talking about. That's not the real essence of unbelief that the Hebrew writer is talking about. Keep reading and see what story he means when he talks about they died for unbelief. Chapter 4 and verse 1. Therefore, let us fear while the promise remains of entering his rest, and lest any one of you should seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have had the good news preached to us, just as Israel did too. Israel was told good news. God is here to deliver you from Egypt and take you to the promised land. We've been told good news. Jesus is here to deliver us from sin and take us to be in God's presence forever. They had a gospel. We have a gospel. The word they heard, however, did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as he swore also as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. What rest is he talking about? What story is he talking about? He's talking about Numbers 13 and 14. Remember the story? First generation, Exodus generation. Yeah, they sinned, and yeah, they had some rebelliousness along the way. But God, by and large, got that generation, that first generation, intact to the border of the promised land. But you get to Numbers 13 and 14. They send those spies in the land. You remember the story? They send the spies in the land, and they come back, and 10 of the 12 say what? 10 of the 12 say, it's too hard, it's too dangerous, this cannot be done. Only Joshua and Caleb dissent. And the nation as a whole, yes, there's been some problems along the way. Yes, there's been some everything from the golden calf to some rebelliousness and some grumbling and some murmuring along the way. But God has not destroyed the nation as such yet for that. He's got them to the doorstep of the promised land. But when the last test comes, the majority of the nation, virtually all of the nation, says, it's too hard, it's too dangerous, it's too frightening. We give up. Let's go back to Egypt. We give up. Let's go back to where we came from. We give up. They believed. They heard the gospel. They walked through the wilderness to this point. Water from the rock, manna from heaven, all of it. But when they get to the doorstep of the land, so close to God's rest that he had offered them, they gave up. The warning, chapter 4 and verse 3. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as he had said, as I swore in my wrath, they will not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day for all his works. And again in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. Therefore, it says, there remains for some to enter it. And those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, which is called unbelief elsewhere, because you really don't believe in God no matter what you say. If you don't hold fast to your hope, if you don't hold fast to your assurance, if you don't hold fast to your faith so as to obey what God says, even when it's hard, difficult, scary, and it hurts. They had a gospel preached, left the slavery of Egypt, got to the doorstep of the promised land, but missed the rest. The Old Testament image of eternal life. They missed the rest, even though they started on the journey. They couldn't finish it. But the Hebrew writer goes on, chapter 4, verse 7, God has again fixed a certain day, today. A certain day, saying through David after so long a time, just as has been said before, today if you hear his voice. A word of warning, not for ancient Israel, but for modern Christians. Don't harden your hearts. Because after all, if Joshua had actually really given them a rest when that second generation did get to go into the promised land, if Joshua had really given them a rest, then he would not have spoken of another day after that. So the point is, there still remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. There still remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. See, what the Hebrew writer is saying is, listen, that Old Testament story is not just something to teach the kids in Bible classes because it happened and it's true and it tells us God's powerful and works miracles. That story is your story, the Hebrew writer says. The Hebrew writer says basically, listen, Christians, you are Israel. You are the new Israel God always intended. Jesus is Moses. You're Israel. You're traveling through the wilderness of sorrow and sin that is this world. And Christians can, just like Israel of the Old Testament, Israel 1.0, Christians can, through unbelief, fail to trust and obey God. They can get scared. They can get distracted. They can give up because it's hard, it's scary, or it hurts. And because of that, Christians can miss the promised land just like the Exodus generation did, their bodies falling as corpses in the wilderness. And so the Hebrew writer gives his point in chapter 4 and verse 11. Therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. The risk is real. It was real for them. It's still real for us today. But you have this warning, the Hebrew writer says. Christians, you have this warning. You have this analogy. Don't be like Israel under Moses when they missed the promised land. Don't give in to the persecution through unbelief. Don't give up and get discouraged by the hardships of life. Don't get distracted by worldliness, whatever it may be. Don't lose your way in the wilderness and miss the land. When you're closer today than you were yesterday, than you've ever been, every day closer to God's eternal rest. Don't doubt God now. Don't get fearful. Don't leave him for safety, the apparent safety of anything else. You have this warning, you have this analogy, Moses, Israel, in the wilderness. Don't repeat the mistake. And it's in light of that earlier analogy in the book that it becomes all the more significant how Moses does speak, or how the Hebrew writer speaks, rather, in Hebrews 13 and verse 5. I will never desert you, nor will I forsake you. You see, that actually comes from the Old Testament as well, and those are words that Moses delivered to Israel. And that's where it gets interesting how the Hebrew writer begins. Having brought up the analogy of don't be like Israel who died in the wilderness following Moses. Because now you follow Jesus, the true Moses, taking you to a better place. It becomes all the more significant that the Hebrew writer ends his sermon with the words of God through Moses. I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. You see, these words come from Deuteronomy chapter 31. These words that the Hebrew writer quotes come from Moses, God speaking through Moses. These words come from Moses, and are some of Moses' final words, because they come from the end of Deuteronomy. They come from Moses' last day, just before he dies, himself not being able to enter the promised land, missing out on the rest that God had promised his people. And what Moses and God through Moses are saying here is to the second generation, don't repeat the mistakes of the first generation. Moses said to them, I'm 120 years old today. I am no longer able to go and to come. And the Lord has said to me, you will not cross the Jordan. It is the Lord your God who will cross ahead of you. God will destroy the nations before you. Remember when your fathers got scared? They forgot that God's the one who brings the victory. God's the one who fights your battles. They saw the problem. They did not see the God who overcomes any problem. God will cross before you. He will destroy the nations before you, and you will dispossess them. Joshua, which is, by the way, Jesus' name in Hebrew. Joshua is the one who will cross ahead of you, just as the Lord has spoken. The Lord will do to them just as he did to Sihon and the Og, the king of the Amorites, into their land when he destroyed them. The Lord will deliver them up before you, and you shall do to them according to all the commandments which I have commanded you. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. There it is. And then Moses called to Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you will go with this people into the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them. He says this to Joshua. He says this to Jesus. Moses was not the one to make it happen. Jesus, Joshua is. Joshua literally Jesus eternally. Follow Jesus into the land that God swore to their fathers to give them as an inheritance. The Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. In the literal context of Hebrews, where the Hebrew is trying to get Jewish Christians not to go back to Judaism, literally pointing them to a story. Because what happens in the Old Testament is it's not just the line that's quoted, it's the context that's quoted as well when the line is quoted. The whole context comes into play. These Jewish Christians would have remembered this story. They would have remembered this setting that Moses himself says it's Joshua who gives you the rest. Follow him. It's the Lord himself who goes before you, which has literally happened in Jesus of Nazareth, who pioneers the way to God through suffering in this world, the blood of his cross, the resurrection of life. It is Jesus who offers people rest. If we hold fast at the end, if we keep to our confession, if we continue in our hope, because God keeps his promises. And so here it is in Deuteronomy 31, what the Hebrew has done. It's absolutely brilliant. It's a powerful sermon. Don't be like Israel who died in the wilderness. Follow the one who brought Israel into the land at the end. That's the moral of the story, because that's the one who will never leave you or forsake you. He's done it himself first. You follow him now. The only leader, here's Moses, the only leader these second generation Christians have known. If the first generation was scared to go in with Moses at the lead, how much more would the second generation be afraid with Moses dying away, or potentially so? What a frightening and concerning time for the people who heard Moses in Deuteronomy 31. They faced such a great challenge in trying to defeat the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. The giants are still there, you know. And a part of Moses' exhortation to them in the face of this is that God will not fail them nor forsake them. And now here the Hebrew writer at the end of a book designed to encourage Christians goes to the end of the book of Deuteronomy to remind Christians once again, we've been here before, the people of God have. Persecution, pressure, the problems and trials of life, whatever it is that's tempting us to try a different way, to turn back. No, the Hebrew writer says, remember what Moses said to those who have come before. Don't die in the wilderness. Follow Joshua into the land, because God will never leave you nor forsake you. How fitting those words really are at the end of a book like Hebrews. Well, what then for us today? I want to make three quick observations, last couple of minutes I have with you this morning. Three quick observations about what the book of Hebrews, what this powerful use of Israel's story and Moses' testimony, what this does for us today. Because on one level, here we are as relatively comfortable Christians living in a country where separation of church and state is the law of the land. No stormtroopers coming into this assembly this morning messing with us or harassing us. No government taking away property because we're Christians. No threat of severe persecution hanging over our heads. How do we make these words and this concept, this long arc that the Hebrew writer is working in this book, how do we make this our own? How apply these words and this concept to us today, where we're at and where we're living? I want to quickly suggest three ways that I will never leave you nor forsake you has meaning for us today, and then we'll be through for the couple minutes that we have together this morning. Three quick observations about what it really means when we set the words back into this context, what it means that I will never leave you nor forsake you. Number one, and this almost is common sense, this really should go without saying, we abstractly know it's true, but number one, we often have trouble really remembering when the chips are down that true security is only in God. Too often when we're risking job loss for our integrity, it's too easy to sit there and say, I need to compromise because God wants me to feed my family. It's too easy in too many difficult situations to sit there and say, I need to maintain my position because that's what God would want. True security is only found in God and God's way. God, not money, is the real source of security. That's the point. Because in the immediate context of Hebrews 13 and verse 5, that where I will never leave you nor forsake you is given, in the actual full context of that verse, what comes right before in Hebrews 13 and verse 5 is a warning about the love of money. In Hebrews 13 and verse 5, there the Hebrew writer says, make sure that your character is free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because he himself has said, I'll always be there for you. The reason not to worry about your money and your possessions is that God is your real security. After all, that's the real issue behind money for most of us, isn't it? Money brings security and money brings a sense of freedom, and that's what God's supposed to provide. We just find another God who can provide it quicker and under our control. The God of money does what I want when I want. I don't have to receive life or gifts from God. I do what I want when I want because the god of money is always at my beck and call. Ultimately, we like money because we like security, because we like freedom. Remember how the rich fool thought and spoke in Luke chapter 12, his ground brings forth plentifully. He's got more crops and he's got place to store them. He's got food and abundance set aside for many years to come. And so you remember what he says? He doesn't say, thank God for this blessing. That's not what he says. He says, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. My God has blessed me with security and freedom. I have no more problems because the God of mammon has come through. But of course, I think most of you in this auditorium this morning, you remember what the actual end of that story is, don't you? He thought he had no problems. He thought the God of money had taken care of him. Many goods for many years. No more worries about bills or what to eat or where to live. Everything taken care of except for one thing. What happens if you die tonight? And all of a sudden you're back to needing a better God than the God of money. Because the God of money can do a lot. But life and death, that's where real power is at. That's where real need is at. And there's nobody in a thing that can secure life as the one true God can. The rich fool found his security and his freedom in his money. And for many of us, that's still what money means for us today, which is why we want it. It's not that we're greedy outright as such. It's that we want to have a sense of control in our own security. We want to have a sense of control in our own sense of freedom. And so we need to learn to accept that our true security doesn't come from money. It doesn't come from the stock market. It doesn't come from the 401k, the inheritance, the paycheck. It comes from God. In the most immediate context, these lines, I will never leave you, forsake you, remind us that our true security is God. God, not money, provides. But as we keep on explaining the circle out a little bit more and how this concept works at the end of this book, it reminds that God is still with us no matter how big the world looks. God is still with us no matter how big the world looks. There must have been some, when you go back to Deuteronomy 31, there must have been some intimidation factor on the part of Israel. And maybe on the part of Joshua as well, because here's Moses saying, be strong and courageous. And there's God then having to tell Joshua after Moses is dead, be strong and courageous. Maybe even Joshua 1.0, maybe that Joshua was a little bit intimidated as well by what he was up against. He was going to do it, but he was nervous on the inside. I would be, you probably would be too. They look at the prospect of going in the land without Moses, who up to